question. Yes, sir.
I have a question, Ken, just to help with what you were talking about in terms of the impact, the financial impact of your program. Was any of that land scheduled before the fire to be harvested?
No.
No, okay.
Okay. Some of it had been harvested prior in some thinning operations and stuff that we did. And then we had some stands that were unmanaged that were set aside for special or for the spotted owl that were very thick and densely stand.
So the proceeds from the salvage operation is basically additional funds.
Okay. Next question. Yes.
What are the markets for salvage timber versus green? Are they can they use the same way? And can any of on the cost,
what
not the cost, the value,
salvage versus. Okay, who would like to? That wasn't directed at. Who wants to answer that?
Well, the timber markets are really tough right now, and they're down quite a bit. You know, the chip markets are sometimes can be real strong. Right now, they're real down, and the chip markets when they make paper products, they don't want that black wood in there, and so we're really pressed with small diameter or wood that's been really charred. What's even compounds that is when we get bugs that are born in there. After the trees die, then the value of those trees starts to decline as well. So not only is the value of the timber continually being reduced over time, but the markets today are really, really tough. So it's a tough situation to deal with economically. Very, very challenging. And then when you have wildfires concentrated like in the Northwest, especially out north by Colville and in this region, then you start to get a flood within those, you know, localized areas. And so then it compounds it even more. It's tough, and it does really affect the quality of the lumber that comes out of those trees.
Anybody want to add anything to that?
Well, I would just add that, you know, a lot of the wood that comes from these is still good wood. A lot of the fire burned very quickly and only scorched the bark. So that's the wood that Steve's talking about that we want to try and capture. And we won't get the same price for green wood, but we get a fair price if we can get in there as soon as possible before the bugs get in there and it starts staining and those types of things. So we can make money on these sales as long as we're able to react quick enough.
Can you guys talk about how long you have before that wood goes bad?
Let me repeat this. Or Mark, can you raise your voice?
How long do you have before that wood goes bad, before you can't get lumber out of it?
It depends on the species. With ponderosa pine, we got to probably, depending on the spring and the winter, probably till about the end of June or so before the stain sets in. With a Doug fir, anywhere from a year to 18 months, possibly. It just depends on how damaged or burned the wood was.
Yeah, I just echo that. It's really a function of the species. Ponderosa pine is the most vulnerable because it gets this blue stain that decreases its value. So with some of the Doug fir and other woods, it's a little bit longer, but the time frame is still very short. You know, we're looking at, you know, 18 to 24 months at the very maximum. So which is why we're, you know, Mose, I don't envy him having to go through all this analysis. You know, we expedited that to a certain degree so that we could be in there this year, this operational season. So very tight windows.
Okay. Anybody? Okay. Jim.
For Jessica and Mose, I heard you mention that economics is a major objective in the salvage effort. I think it's something I know what part reforestation plays in that, because I think there's a restorative value of restoring a better composition of species in there by planting, possibly, but I wonder if you guys have talked to that. Is that part of the objective of that project?
I'll repeat Jim's question for some in the back. Jim was wondering about, through planting after a burn, changing the composition to a more desirable mix of tree species.
Is that part of the objective?
Is that so, Mose?
Mm-hmm. So the answer is yes. The primary objective is around the economics of the situation. However, we're going to be pursuing it in a way that is looking to change the composition of species. We're looking to remove mainly that grand fir, leave the ponderosa pine. There'll be replanting that takes place that is weighted heavily towards ponderosa, towards large, towards Doug fir. And the idea around I hesitate to oversell the ecological benefit of the salvage sale, but one of the components of it is the idea that by removing this dead and down material, the legacy trees will require for to come through like it has in the last several years. So yes.
Okay. And I'd just like to clarify that regardless of whether or not we salvage this 250 acres, there are other sources of funding that we can pursue for reforestation in other species. But the sale is a really effective way to make sure that we secure those funds.
Okay. Emma?
Yes. From a fire ecologist standpoint, what was significant about Spruce Creek Fire, and based on that, what are your concerns for future fire season?
Did everybody hear the question? Okay. Let's see if I can review.
I asked Jessica what was significant about Spruce Creek Fire, and based on that, what were her concerns about future fire season?
So what was special about, from an ecological standpoint, about this fire? And what about the future? Jessica?
So I think I would point out that all of the fires that we've had on Mount Adams for the last 14 years or so have individually, from my perspective, been within the natural range of variability as far as the extent of them or the size, the severity, as in the mix of low, moderate, and high severity, and in their fire return interval. Many of them were at the stage where it was time for them to burn. However, the significance, I think, is that we've had so many recently. So we're at this point have just a really large number of acres affected. As far as my concerns for future fires, I think the only one would be that when you have areas that reburn several times in a row, you can really lose some of those ecological niches, because otherwise it's a little bit easier. Fire as a natural process occurs, and fans can revegetate and habitat can be reformed. But when you have an area that's been affected three times within 4 years, it's going to be a lot more difficult for those ecological niches to be reclaimed.
Thank you.
Which
question over here?
A lot of concerns go on for me around salvage logging. Probably the most significant, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, but the flooding, the concerns about the soil. I would like to hear from each of the foresters, from DNR, from the tribes. What will you be doing when you're out there doing salvage logging to protect the soils? Protect the soils from becoming even more impacted than they were by the fire, and not just for flooding and for water quality, but also just for future reforestation. Studies that I've read from the Biscuit Fire in Oregon, which is very similar to this fire, were very hot and very big damage. Salvage logging was had bad effects. So the areas that were not salvage logged did better at recovering from the fire than the areas that were. And I guess I'd like to just hear how each of the different groups is going to address protecting from even further damage to those fragile soils.
Good, thank you. I think each of I'm going to start with Jay, then go to DNR, then we'll go to Yakima, and we'll end
with Jay. Start over there, since I don't manage anything.
I know Jay well enough that he's got opinions. Okay, you start?
I'm going to start on that one.
For the Forest Service, at least, it starts with identifying lands that where the soils have not been severely impacted. So we look specifically at finding areas that have only had moderate soil impacts, because the soils do end up being much more fragile after these sorts of fires. So it starts with identifying appropriate lands, and then there's several mitigations that we put in place around these timber sales. One, there are areas where we have minimal timber roofs. I think we have to stay within a half mile total across those three units. And then the contractors themselves have several mitigations we put in place around laying slash down beneath heavy machinery as it's rolling through, developing temp roads with the appropriate rolling dips, and I think we have no stream crossings, actually. And actually, this area that we're looking at now is minimal stream crossing, so it's nice that we don't have that same concern about sediment delivery. And then ultimately, we end up relying on our soil scientists to avoid specific areas. I know there's units here that have been shaped to avoid specific areas that are particularly fragile. And we look at that analysis, and I don't want to give the impression that we've actually made the decision on moving forward on this salvage. We are in the analysis process. We are looking at impacts, and we are receiving input, you know, from groups like these and from anyone who wants to apply to scoping. So we take a hard look at that, and we think about that, and we see if it's worth, see if we're confident enough in our mitigation measures, and see if it's worth the benefits of moving into that area.
Before I turn it over to DNR, I want to make a point what Jose made. They are looking for input. They're at this, what's called scoping stage. So if you have thoughts, whatever they are, he's the guy to see. He'll give you a card or his email address. Okay, let's hear the perspective on from DNR. Which one of you three guys wants to?
We got to go in order.
Thanks,
DNR. Up to you. Your voice, please.
Sure. If the panel members would speak up, please. You
okay.
Do not have the microphone.
Okay.
Now,
if you got a soft voice, maybe stand.
Yeah.
Check out.
Okay. Everybody hear me? Okay. All right. Okay. What we do at the DNR is, again, we showed it on the map. We look at the whole area. We whittle it down to the area that we're going to impact. We're staying off unstable slopes. If it was unstable, we totally eliminated those soils from the operation. We're not operating on slopes greater than 30%. Hopefully, this operation will be with snow cover on frozen ground. And then on skid trails, we're going to be designating the skid trails. We've got a compliance officer that will be out there. They will be putting in water bars and splash on the skid trails. And then we'll be watching the timing as far as the haul roads and stuff. So we're going to be watching that pretty close. We've gone through the forest practices. They've looked at that, the regulators. And we've gone through the CEPA comment, and we've done an environmental checklist to identify those areas. And remember, we're looking at less than 2% of the impacted area out there. And there's no stream crossings.
Thank you. Ken, do your colleagues, anybody?
Larry, Albert, you guys
Larry,
you missed
Albert,
something?
Anything to add?
No, I think...
Can you speak up, please?
So our big effort with our salvage operation is to the impacts that we... Or I guess the operation of salvage, our hope is that we've done enough mitigations where any additional sediment is minimized by, like Ken said, the frozen ground or dry season logging, and the staying on gentle slopes, limiting how much disturbance from the mechanized equipment. That all helps us minimize any additional impacts from the salvage itself, recognizing that there's an inherent disturbance because of the fire, and the loss of the organic material on the ground is going to cause erosion, which we're seeing right now today.
Thank you. Albert, Ed?
Well, one thing I would just say is this fall has been quite dramatic in the rainfall. We've already had 16 inches at Houston, where I measure, and that Halloween weekend, that was 3 inches, at least in Houston, so in Glenwood. Probably similar. I've worked here 17 years, and it seems like most of the time fall goes into winter, you know, snow on dust kind of events. I know people that have been here longer, it seems like things are unusual, the amount of rainfall we've had and the erosion, which might have flooded out Glenwood regardless of the fire. Just seems a little different to me.
Thank you. You raise a good point. What is going to be our new norm with weather patterns? Something to think about. Steve?
On fires on the Yakima Reservation, especially large fires, we always take a look at impacts to soil before we do anything. And so we've got a fantastic soil scientist, PhD soil scientist. We look at the soil type. We've got a good inventory of the soil type, the severity of the burn, because that's going to affect the what the soil does. The slopes, well, we still do a fair amount of buffering along stream corridors. We look at road improvement projects where we want to see more graveled roads as opposed to open roads where we get a lot of that sedimentation down. We do seasonal logging so that we're not up there in the wettest of conditions. So what we try to do is minimize those impacts. The Yakima Nation is very, very concerned of water quality. They're fisheries pride. They've invested millions and millions and millions of dollars into restoration of fisheries resources along the Klickitat and its tributaries. And so that's a really important factor is protecting that soil. But at the same time, kind of balancing that out with really what's needed in terms of economic returns. One of the things that we get from our soil scientists is that actually breaking up some of that is not necessarily a bad thing, so that sometimes you get that real hard crust layer. So breaking that up, that continuity, is sometimes kind of a good thing. Mark, you want to add anything to that?
Covered it pretty well. I think it's also important. I think people
speak up, Mark.
People have mentioned that if we do nothing, there's still going to be quite a bit of sediment delivery into the water, into the streams.
Can you stand up? Your voice is the softest.
Sorry.
Please repeat.
Regardless of what we do or what we don't do, if we did nothing, there's still going to be a great deal of sediment delivery into the streams. This fire burned, at least on the reservation, burned very hot in places. There's a lot of steep slopes, and we've already seen, and you guys, I'm sure, have seen this already. Don't be surprised the next few years you'll see a lot of muddy water, and it's just the way it's. You're going to have to get used to it, and it's going to be a while before this area recovers. We're going to do, millions of trees are going to be planted, and that will eventually help, but it's going to take a while.
So again, can I just offer one piece of information?
Yes.
The map that you guys, I believe, have actually as a handout, the severity map, and that Daryl showed in his presentation, I think.
That's this map right here.
That's a soil burn severity map, or what we call a BARC map, burned area reflectance classification. So what we also have at this point is what we call a ravage map, or a rapid assessment of vegetation after fire. And that's now available as well, and that's done within 3 months after a burn. And so, Daryl, I can send you that, because in some cases that's more appropriate to look at. In some cases, soil is more appropriate to look at. And then 1 year post-burn, we'll do another vegetative assessment of the severity. So that map that you have, though, is soil severity. So if you want to reference that, that's a good map to go to.
Thank you, Jessica. Can you send it either to Daryl or Darvo?
Yeah.
And we'll get it out there. But Jeremy.
I just want to say, we commend Steve and Jose and DNR and your staff for putting in the hard work to get these salvages put together. And the reason why it's surprising is that our companies are that interested in the burnt wood for the reasons that we discussed earlier, contamination with chip streak and all that. We do think it's the right thing to do for ourselves for a lot of the reasons that Ken talked about in the presentation. So good with you guys. We'd actually like to see you do a little more, but I'm glad you've done what you do. And the lady up front, she raised a valid concern, but I think it's important to keep the salvage operations in perspective. When you look at that map where two-thirds of the perimeter of the mountain is now burned in the last 10 or 15 years, look at the acres that we're harvesting out there that have been salvaged in the past, that are trying to be salvaged now, and it's a drop in the bucket. So just keep it in perspective, and I think you guys are doing a good job.
Jay, you've been thinking?
All right. It's more of a question in terms of, Mose mentioned the bear funds, burned area emergency response funds, and I actually inquired with Larry at one point, as I know a couple people did in Glenwood, as to whether there are any kind of preventative or mitigation types of efforts that could have been funded through something like that. And apparently that's not available for private and state lands. But I guess one question I would have is to whether there might be any thoughts during the harvest to do more than just deal with water barring and look at soil conditions when you're actually logging, but whether you might place some contour logs on slopes or purchase some straw bales or something for check dams or flows or erosion control devices. Is there a thought that's been given to that, at least on the non-federal grounds?
Jessica's nodding her head.
Non-federal.
Well, non-federal, so I'll be honest, As a Forest Service manager, I've been most focused on the national forest lands. I have not put a lot of thought into what's happening on the private side or the Yakima side beyond the kind of cumulative effects of the potential actions.
I think there are some cost share available for the small private landowners out there through the conservation district and farm services. But as far as DNR, Larry,
we don't have a program that deals with that.
I want to also introduce Jamie Palfrey. Jamie, can you stand up? Jamie is the facilitator for the, it's called the South Gifford Pinchot Collaborative. We wrestle with, and I'm on that group too, we wrestle with a lot of these same questions. Do you have any thoughts on that?
My thought was, how much interaction is there across boundary? You know, we're talking about this all-hands, all-lands approach, and how much do you guys connect with each other about what you're doing, and how much could that be improved if there was a concerted effort?
Any comment?
Yeah, I'll comment on that. Yeah, more than we used to, not enough, to be honest with you, really. And you know that. We've participated a little bit more actively. We've been working with the Forest Service, the State DNR, and us. We have a good partnership. But we are very concerned with how we manage lands, or maybe in some cases how we don't manage lands, and how we may affect our neighbors. That was very apparent in... on the 2008 Cold Springs fire, and so it's real important to us. So what we do, and or what we don't do, and how it affects our neighbors, and this good neighbor policy, things like that. And we continue to do more of it as we join collaboratives and continue to interact with each other.
Okay, want to hear some other? I have to ask Susan, my wife.
I was just wondering if you guys talk about the effect on the ranching.
So, can you speak up, Susan?
I just was wondering if some of the ranchers would talk about the effect on how this is going to affect the ranching.
Yeah. Neil, can you answer that? Or the question was, how about these kinds of fires and their effect on ranching? Neil?
Well, it's very devastating. You know, this is the third fire in so many years that's affected that area up there. And this is the most severe, no doubt about it. There was several $1,000s worth of cattle losses. Fire, and not only the natural resources, but everything else. And for years to come, the cattle are going to take a hit, just like the forestry and the river park. I think there's a lot of proactive things that can be done to stop these things from happening again. I think the panel all knows what those are. If they can get them done or not, it's another question. Yeah. That's my big concern. We got to be proactive. We haven't been for the last 70 years and see what it's got us.
I just want to mention, I talked to Neil via cell phone, and I called him up on the fire because I was wondering and concerned, and he was up there with his cowboys rounding him up right in the middle of the fire. Pretty risky. High risk. Okay, another
question. Day after day, they rounded them up in the small...
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yes, sir.
This question has to do with ground cover restoration, and it's directed to any land manager who might wish to comment. Do you plan to depend primarily upon the soil seed bank to revegetate the ground cover, or do you be tempted to do reseeding? And if anybody is going to be reseeding, is there going to be any issue with regard to exotic species in the production?
Okay.
So, will
everybody hear the question?
No.
Okay, can you repeat the question?
Well, this question has to do with ground cover restoration after the fire, and it's directed to any land manager who might be interested in the problem. So the first part of the question is, do you plan to depend primarily on the soil seed net to revegetate? And if not, and you will be reseeding with introduced seed, is there likely to be an exotic species issue?
Okay, thank you for receiving. Okay.
So, for the portion of the fire that was on the National Forest, we do have native seed available. So we have a seed bank that we can use. Right now, the concern is more about whether or not we'll be able to have the funds to implement the sort of extensive seeding that we would like to see. Ideally, you would do that from the air. There's a big price tag associated with that. We've actually had some members of the collaborative group come to us with some potential partners that might be able to help us get that seed distributed via air. If we can't do it from the air, we'll probably end up doing a certain amount of the high priority areas on the ground. But we do have the appropriate seed available, which is excellent.
Anybody can? Steve?
We're not going to do any large-scale reseeding. If we did on a small localized level, it would be using natural seed. What we found, and from our various disciplines that look at this, even in the more severe burns, we get a pretty good flush of natural native species coming up. Along that Klickitat bench, it's a very, very productive site. And so we're going to get an abundance of not just grasses, but a lot of brush coming in as well. So we think those natural responses are going to occur just fine. What we're concerned about is getting tree species in there of the right species composition. And so we're going to be focusing our efforts more along the vegetation relating to the seedlings.
Got a question? Okay, yes, sir.
My house is about
My house is about
60 feet from Bird Creek in Glenwood, and I can attest here immediately to the incredible speed of which the runoff starts to flow. In the last two or three storms that we've had in Glenwood, there's been acre feet of water literally going by both above and below my house. My house is high and dry. But this raises a historical question that I would like to run by the panel. When I first came to Glenwood in 1960, I was told that all that, I believe, orchard grass that is all over the east side of Mount Adams was started by the sheep herders with a few saddlebags full of grass seed that they threw out when they were running their sheep up there. Well, the impact of that orchard grass spread all over the entire south and east and I guess north slopes of Mount Adams. And I guess my question to the panel is, and I realize that it's very expensive to helicopter seed, or any other kind of seed is expensive, but it looks to me like that aerial strips or even hand strips with ATVs or whatever, where it's possible, that alternate strips of aerial seeding or whatever kind of grass seeding would be an immediate, quicker response to the runoff potential than waiting for the natural tree seedlings and brush seedlings. Would the panel comment?
I'm going to repeat the question. It's a giant question. A lot of concerns, but I'll try to summarize it. One, you live on Bird Creek in Glenwood.
Yes.
You've been watching what's going on with the water and the changes. The question evolves around, he feels that the sheep herders, probably turn of the century, early teens, spread a lot of what is it's a non-native species called orchard grass, and it's generally used for erosion and other things. Your question was, of the panel, are there other thoughts and ways you have to get the better types of native plant species quickly in this area? Either, you mentioned either aerial or other ways. So thoughts?
I keep starting, so I'll start once again. Good to see you, Lynn. When we look at doing immediate restoration kind of work, it's called emergency stabilization. And that's the piece of the pie that Len's talking about on the Yakima lands. And what we have to show is that there are resources at risk that require a certain implementation of a stabilization effort. So could we get a helicopter, stick some seed in it, fly it over, whether it's orchard grass or something else, and have it funded out of that emergency stabilization money? It depends on the resources at risk. With all due respect to your house, it's kind of high and dry. So we have to show that what we do is really necessary, that we absolutely have to have that the quickest turnaround time. And usually that relates to things like replacing culverts and increasing the size. You know, making sure the ditches are clean, chipping some wood to get a little bit of ground cover on there, and things like that. So could we do it? Yeah, we could do it, but it's got to kind of pass that test of whether it's needed because of resource values.
Yes.
And I would just add to what Steve said that not only do you have to show that there's a value, but you have to show that it's more valuable than all of the other fires that we had in the region this last year. So with a fire season like we had in 2015, those federal pots of money are really competitive to get those funds. So you don't just have to show that there's a value that you need to that seeding money for, but you have to show that it's more valuable than everything else.
Thank you, Jessica. That point is especially relevant right now with all the fires we had last season. Was there anybody else?
I'll throw out there that, you know, since we have an active grazing program on our lands, what I witnessed while I was up fighting the fire was a lot of the bunch grass was bunched down short enough where the fire didn't really kill a lot of it. So I think that a lot of that's going to resprout for a large part of our ownership and help with that immediate stabilization that you're looking for, and hopefully, you know, accelerate that ground vegetation recovery.
Larry, I'm glad you made that point. My goal is to get every other year to get back to major project fires to see what is coming back. And when I went there a couple years ago, there was a big fire up Mill Creek over out of the dam, and I monitor that a couple times in the past 2 years. What Larry was saying, the bunch grasses are really coming up because they got all that release of nitrogen and boy, they're just taking off. Okay, a couple more questions, and then we're going to ask the panel if they got a couple comments or so to wrap it up. Yes, I'm going to go right there.
Harry Muller from Glenwood. I'm board of director of the Hubbard Irrigation Company. And since the fire is put it down here, you know, we've had pretty heavy rains. I mean, we've had hit rains like this before in the past, but we've never been hit like we have during these rains. We've lost two pieces of infrastructure on our irrigation system that we know of. We don't know what the headworks of the hell roaring and muddy is since this last one. They don't even know whether it's there. But it's just, there's nothing there on those hillsides to keep the water. And I think the sooner we get grass planted in there, the better off we're going to be, and it's going to protect the fish, it's going to protect the wildlife, it's going to rebuild that ground. Sure, maybe the timber companies aren't real in favor of it because they're wanting the regeneration of those trees real fast. Those trees will come. I mean, that's a good high moisture area. And Leonard lives on Bird Pick, but the Hellhorn Irrigation Company is what keeps our Glenwood Valley green all summer. Most everybody here has been to Glenwood a few times. And they usually marvel when they fall in there in August and they see all this green grass and things growing and cattle thriving. And the other places are all dried up and not looking very healthy. But anyhow, that's what we want to keep.
All right, thank you. Thank you for that perspective. That was more a comment on a subject that hadn't been touched on very much before. Okay, one more there and one back there, and then we're going to call it. Yes.
Yeah, my question is, from what this gentleman said about the huge amounts of dirt and topsoil coming down off the mountain, specifically, what have you done to look at the effects of that on the salmon runs and in the watershed to address specifically for the salmon? All that excessive runoff that we have.
Who wants to take
from
that?
The mountain.
Did you,
like,
did you have a... Can you want to try first?
Is that addressed Steve? In your analysis or not?
You want to try, Steve?
Nothing. You know, what are the effects on salmon runs right now? We don't know. What we do know is that the Yakimas have a very active fisheries program, and they do spawning surveys every year, and so I think that data will come out, but it's going to take, you know, a particular amount of time to gather it. So immediately we don't do anything other than our standard spawning surveys at regular intervals.
I guess, I mean, it seems like there's past fires with this kind of damage, and you'd have some data about how those streams are apt to affect, you know, how those fire, that debris is apt to affect those streams. I'm wondering if there could be more proactive thought about it, and because salmon do require clean, healthy streams. I mean, maybe there's a reason to actually consider planting some grass to stabilize those soils.
Mark, you want to take it?
We are.
Can you stand up, please, and speak
really?
And bottom of your gut.
We are not harvesting within riparian areas. We'll get close if there's if there are areas that are burned areas that are close to that riparian area. We'll get close, but we're not going to go into the riparian areas. You do have a point that you know planting, seeding these areas could potentially and probably will reduce the amount of sedimentation and going into the water. The problem is that you know, what has been said before is that we do need, I mean, there's limited resources, limited funding available, and amount of time that's going, I mean, what is it, 40,000 acres within the tribal lands. That's a huge amount of area, and you know, I'm just saying it would be very difficult to cover that huge amount.
Okay, so Mark, I'm going to have to cut it off. I got promised to this gentleman back there one quick question, then I want everybody to have just a quick comment or two from the panel. Yes.
Talking about that bird, it seems like it's actively responding to a particular situation, but I'm very concerned about the more strategic question. We had decades of historical management, which means in some cases mismanagement practices on upland and private land. If you look at, and I did some of this research at the University of California when I was in San Diego down there, if you look at the advances in global change growth, you're likely to see more intense and more frequent global growth manifest itself. Well, I haven't seen any of these agencies talk at all about the possibility that there is a significant, much larger scale strategic problem that needs to be addressed. Perhaps not at a, definitely not at a local level. The local level has to have some input into developing a national strategic strategy. And I'm wondering if any of these agencies, including the Forest Service, have thought about that and if they're making any headway.
So I would agree with you that what we have been talking about here is specific to this one particular incident, this one particular location. Especially from the Forest Service side, I've been talking about this proposal for 250 acres of work, and 250 acres of work is minuscule compared to what it would take to actually have a proactive impact on the way these fires behave on our landscape. I would want to point out that for the Forest Service and the National Forest and the projects that we're involved in here, we are looking at this entire watershed for something we're calling the Upper White Restoration Project, and we're working with a collaborative group on something that, I don't know, scope of the analysis is, I don't know, it's in the 80,000 acre range. It covers the entire southern and western half of Mount Adams outside of that wilderness area. So we will be looking at a variety of treatments and strategies that expand beyond the boundaries of this fire. So there is an opportunity now to get involved in that conversation, in that analysis. In terms of the nationwide strategy, I think you're absolutely right. I think we find ourselves oftentimes taking very small bites out of the problem, proposing kind of tactical, small little solutions and responses. I think that's the reality. I think a big part of why that is, is because of the limitations on the capacity that we have. We have wonderful employees, very talented, very skilled, very dedicated. There's only so much that they can accomplish with the funding that they're given, with the hours that they have in the day. This country is not particularly supportive of a large, robust public management agency. That's just not where the public is right now. If we are to make headway and to have a real change in the way we manage these lands for the public, the way we steward these resources, it would require higher taxes, it would require more federal employees, it would require a lot of things that are not particularly popular. And so we find ourselves taking the small bites where we can, being as creative and as efficient as we possibly can. But I don't think we're going to see any major shift in the strategies that are taken until there's a major shift in what the public expects of us.
Eloquently.